This is a story of how a million children were placed with local foster families through an unlikely alliance between the Chinese government and a British footballer. Parents from all walks of life share their stories of overcoming the one-child policy by taking in orphans. With unprecedented access across the country, this is a unique insight into the lives of the 90s orphans now driving the 21st century's fastest growing economy. This story needs to be told across the world. At a time where there's so much negativity and cynicism, here's proof that a single leap of faith can change the world.
Exploration Films, the art of truth.
Welcome to the Exploration Films podcast. I'm your producer and host, Steve Ryder. Imagine being a professional soccer player, football, if you're outside the US, and being asked by the Chinese government to come in and develop a foster care system. Then imagine taking your large family to a country that would be completely foreign to them and the pushback from that entrenched orphan care system, as well as some government officials who were skeptical of a Westerner bringing fresh ideas in. Well, that's the situation Robert Glover found himself in. And through his work, millions of kids were pulled out of orphanages. Today's film we're featuring is Children of Shanghai, a beautiful film that's narrated by Bear Grylls. It's packed with touching stories of the impact of what a loving family can do for a child stuck in the orphanage system, as well as the impact of what one man can do to change the life trajectory of millions. I had the recent pleasure of chatting with Robert about his story, his impact in China, what he's doing now, and this film. Robert Glover, thanks for being on the Exploration Films podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Looking forward to it.
I loved this film. And I mean, it was so well done and visually was beautiful, the way in which you told the stories of the children and your story. So let's set it up for the listeners right now. Let's hear your story and how you ended up in China, working on really establishing a foster care system there in China.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we, as a family, we were a young family, and I'd just been promoted through the system in the UK, and I was running, you know, family placement and general social welfare reform when I had this opportunity to go to China. And I think as well, we were in a place where we were ready to, you know, move on and do what God would have for us. So in that respect, when China came along, we jumped at it, and it was a challenging move. Look, we were in a beautiful place called Guernsey in the Channel Islands. We had a lovely old house, beaches, the children had fantastic schools. And here was this opportunity to go to one of the biggest cities in the world, Shanghai. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the negotiations, it was very clear that, you know, they had a one-child policy. They wanted me to be their consultant. And we had six children. So, you know, there were lots of things we could laugh about with the way that this was all put together. But, you know, I think there were a couple of key milestones that really made it absolutely 100% sure that we needed to be in Shanghai. I think many years back, I had this man who came over to the island. We were at church on a Sunday morning. He came to pray with me, and he prayed this prayer that somehow I was going to be a father to as many children as there were stars in the sky, which, you know, I thought, well, I better check that out with my wife. That's a big deal. And we kind of, you know how you do, you put it into a box, and, you know, it could be Sunday school or youth work or whatever you're doing at the time.
Yeah.
But then 96 came, and during 96, I had an Australian guy pray for me, and he prayed that I'd be in an earthquake within that year, and it's where God wanted me to be. So they were pretty heavy duty prophecies that were given into my life. And it wasn't till I was in Shanghai when I had these initial meetings with the Shanghai government. So in the evening, I was in my room. The traveling partner that came with me, and we noticed the curtains were moving and things were rocking around, and we weren't really sure what was going on, so went out into the hallway to try and find someone. Everyone else had left. And as I stood in the door frame, I heard that Australian guy, within this year, you'll be in an earthquake. And it was an earthquake. So it gets your attention. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when we came to sign the agreement with the Chinese, they said, you've got to have a Chinese name and a chop. So when you're writing reports, we know it's from you. And they spent a lot of time talking about what my Chinese name would be. And then one guy stood up and said, look, we want to tell you what the meaning of your name is, because that's really important in China.
And what was your Chinese name?
This was the Chinese name, yeah. It was, as many stars are on the sky, you'll be father to children in China, which, of course, I knew straight away. So I think we were pretty clear where we had to go.
What was that word in Chinese?
Lo Baba, which is like old father, Father Abraham. So we knew it was an Abrahamic call in that sense. Never, ever thought that, we would see the numbers that we have seen in the time. You know, for a time we had this vision for a million, which was a bit audacious. I think my American friends helped me with that in the sense, you know, you guys are very positive. Here in the UK, everybody's pessimistic. like, what are you talking about? A million children, you know? And I used to say, well, I might not see it in my lifetime, but, you know, if God's going to do it, I believe him for it.
It was scary. I'd never been to China. I didn't have a clue what it meant to live there and actually to take our six children. But the thing that made it feel more secure was that we would be helping other children that were in much worse conditions and much worse situations than my children.
Dad said, this is what I think we need to do. We need to move to China. And I think I burst into tears.
All we had left was our mattresses. So the final bit was to go up and have this little time together and set fire to our mattresses and say goodbye to Guernsey. It was, you know, goodbye. And from that point, again, there was this freedom, this liberty that just broke through that we are going to China. It was a change point. It was a new direction.
What were those challenges during those first months or years there in Shanghai?
Well, I think the big challenge, obviously, is the kids. You know, you've got six children and, you know, I'm wanting to get on with the program and work with the government, but you've got to also take care, you know, make sure everybody else is on board. So take care of your wife and your children and the schooling. And the head guy in Shanghai, the director of civil affairs in Shanghai, was brilliant. I used to meet with him once a month. We'd have a meal together. And he said to me, look, Robert, he said, the first thing you do is you get your house and then you get your house near a school so you can get your children, you know, across the road from the school. And then we'll work out where your office is and all the other bits because you can travel on. And it was really sound advice. You know, we found this school actually that was starting up in Shanghai. It was a Christian school, Concordia International.
A Christian school in communist China?
In Shanghai, yeah. So, you know, I think when we started, we were a third of the pupils. There were about 20 children that started it, and I think we had six. So, they were praying for kids, and we turned up with a minibus full of them. And so we got a house on the other side of the road, and we started to build life. And it was in outside of Shanghai in a village. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a great introduction to Chinese culture, Chinese life, people. Yeah, we had some wonderful times there in the early days.
How were you and your family received in a country with a one-child policy and you're coming in with six kids?
Well, of course, they're all blonde. And so wherever we went, you know, we were just a spectacle. We remember going on to the Bund, which is a very popular area of Shanghai down by the river. And we were having a, you know, good old-fashioned English picnic with sandwiches and yeah, crisps and apple. I think you call them chips, we call them crisps. And, we're dishing out things and realizing, hang on, kind of got the impression someone was looking at you, looked up and there was probably about 500 Chinese people all stood in a circle around us, you know, looking at what we were doing. And, but, you know, those early days in that village were key because I think the first Christmas we were there, we invited the elder of the village and all the people in the village into our house for a Christmas meal. And I said to him, Now, do you want Chinese food or would you like to try Western? Oh, we'd like to try your Western food, he said. So they all came round and everybody came in and I got my friends round and I said, let's put something really traditional together. So we got a Christmas turkey. We have turkey in the UK at Christmas. And we had mince pies and we had Christmas cake and trifle and chili con carne and all these different Western dishes. And of course, he goes first and he got his bowl and he got a spoonful of chili con carne and then he got the Christmas cake on top and then a mince pie and he was mashing it all in. And wow, this food is lovely. And of course, everyone followed suit with putting bits of turkey and trifle and, you know, So that was our first introduction. And then in the evening, we lit all the candles in the house and we sang Silent Night in Chinese together. So very simple. And we just became really good friends with the people in that village.
Astonishingly, Robert's friendly approach and genuine love of Chinese food achieved what the entire Western establishment had failed to do for years.
Chinese do everything through guangxi, which means relationship. It's very much over food. It's very much getting to know and trust. And face is very important in China. You don't make anyone lose face. You know, you keep their honor and face, so it's very important.
Your assistant said in the film, that early on you were looked at with suspicion. Why?
Well, I guess, you know, China has always got a bit of a bashing from the West, and they always think that there's a sting in the tail, I think. And it takes a long time to win trust, to win over their respect. And I think initially they just think, well, what's the catch? And there had been, you know, adverse publicity about the way Chinese had cared for their children. What they hadn't expected is that we'd come with a servant heart to empower them and encourage them to make a better way for their children. So I think not everybody was on board at the beginning. There were some that were, you know, obviously wanting to learn and develop, but, you know, the old guard really just saw the West as, you know, the imperialistic nations that looked down on China.
Is that problem being exacerbated? Because we're recording this in December, and countries like, I just saw Canada was added to the list that isn't sending any diplomatic delegations to Beijing for the Winter Olympics. Do you feel, from having spent so much time there, from a Chinese perspective, are they going to take it in the way in which that, you know, the West is trying to call them out for Hong Kong, call them out for the Uyghurs, call them out for the human rights abuses and the way the clampdowns and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Things change. And one of the things I always say, we shouldn't judge a nation by their administration. We certainly don't do that of the US, you know, just because one administration's in it, it colors all the people. Look, when we were in China, China went through that whole stage from the 90s through to, you know, when we left, where it was opening up and there was a harmonious society. They brought 500 million people out of poverty. And so, you know, I think there's always challenges that come about from, you know, changes of administration. And I think, you know, I haven't lived in China during Xi Jinping's tenure, but I'm sure that there are some that could talk about the positives and some about the negatives. For me, living in China, there were always challenges. There were always challenges around the differences of, you know, freedoms of democracy against how actually through totalitarian systems you get things done very quickly and very efficiently. So, you know, you've got these, but it wasn't something that I focused on in the sense because the people that we met, you know, were very genuine, humble, honest, loving people. The people that took these children, you'll see in the documentary, you know, incredibly caring of the children they took in and very resilient and worked hard. Humorous, you know, you look at the old guy in the film, how humorous he was. Yet we are easy to judge people from across different nations just because of the small amount of people that are running the country at that time. So my message always is, you know, don't judge the Chinese people because of the administration at the moment. or in the past or in the future. You know, the people are the same right across. And, you know, from my experience of living in China, for the amount of time I have been there, they're some of the most beautiful, humble people you'll ever meet in the world.
When it came out this fall, my boys and I went to go see Shang-Chi, the Marvel movie about, you know, the Chinese superheroes that they added to the Marvel universe. And in watching that movie, this deep appreciation for Chinese culture just kind of bubbled up. And yeah, it's a beautiful culture and it's a beautiful country. And I agree, I'm torn between the administration, but the people, And I have the same feeling personally about, you know, Iran/Persia. The people are so beautiful, but yet the regime is the regime and all the problems that, you know, the West has with them. And so, yeah, I could definitely see being there and just developing this just love for the people on the ground. So when you got there, your foster care idea wasn't well received, was it?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think the social reformers were ready for it. But, you know, it's the same in any country. If you go in and you're looking at change, and change which might affect people on the ground, then you are going to get that element of resistance because people naturally resist change. So when I was first in the Shanghai State Welfare Institution for Children, I was very aware that, you know, some of the old guard were not happy I was there. The youngsters seemed, you know, pretty interested. But so I said to the guy who was looking after me or, you know, working with me, is everybody happy that I'm here? And he said, And he sort of thought about it. You could see the brain cogs going around. And he said, well, probably a third don't want you here. There's probably a third that actually couldn't care less. They're just coming in to get do their work, get their pay and go home. And then there's another third, the younger generation, that are really interested and really want to learn and change. So, you know, I was very aware of that. I wasn't allowed to eat in the canteen with the rest of the staff. I had to eat my lunch on my own. And what I did notice is that although some of the younger children were getting placed into families, which was excellent, some of the older, and especially the older boys, were not. And teenagers being what they are were much more challenging. So I decided I would take, when I was a young man, I played very good standard of football, you call soccer. So I played in the English as a professional. So I used to take a ball out and play with them and show them, coach them a bit. And it got a bit more serious. There were, I think, initially six of them. It grew to nine. Yeah. And then we had enough for a team. And so training got a bit more serious. And I sent for this, I wrote to my old team and they sent out the youth strip, which was very, you know, very good. And I think Manchester United came out and then Liverpool, and we did a bit of training with them. And we decided here was a team of quite disabled teenage boys, and we entered them into the Shanghai Schools Trophy. Well, of course, we ended up in the final against the American school, and you can imagine it got a lot of interest. You know, here's the American school. They're going to whoop these lads from the orphanage. Well, you know, they turned out a great performance and won 5-3. And that brought honor to the orphanage. You know, the bringing that cup back and the media and all that really made a difference. And so the next morning, knock on my door, and there was Madam Wong with all the staff and my bowl with my name on, which meant I could then go and eat with the rest of the staff in the canteen.
You had other obstacles while you were there that you had to work through and overcome, like the entrenched orphanage industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we, you know, the pilot project was very successful in Shanghai, and that's mainly due to the fact that we had, you know, some very influential support from the Shanghai government. When I moved from Shanghai up to Beijing, I then started work with a man called Yaming Fu, who was Mao's Russian translator and then Minister of Civil Affairs. Yeah, quite an incredible man. And he certainly made a way for us to move into other provinces. But I think there was always a challenge because many of the orphanages were being run, they were invested interests. for them, for the staff. And again, if you're changing the system, there's always the fear that you're going to lose your job. So it was very important to win them on side and tell them, look, this is part of career development. And, you know, we'll train you to move with the children. So you're not going to lose your jobs. And I think that was a key component of the success.
I think the Chinese government must have recognized in him exactly the qualities that I saw, which was his sincerity, his genuineness, his care for children, his enthusiasm for the job.
We rolled out initially to 15 provinces and then 30 provinces of China. And I think once that then started to roll out and people saw the numbers and the, you know, how easy the success was in seeing children lives transform, it turned out to be very productive in the long run.
How many kids in total did you place during your time there?
So we went back in 2018 to film the documentary Children of Shanghai. While we were there, the Beijing Bureau of Statistics told me that 85% of the children now in China were living in families. And of course, I had this vision for a million, which you know, some people back in the UK thought was ridiculous. And so I was asking him, how many people? And he said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, how many children? He said, I don't know. I said, well, he said, give me 24 hours and I'll let you know. So next day we were at this conference and he was there. And I said, I couldn't help myself. Is it a million? He said, no, it's not. It's much more than a million. So we knew that God had honored that. You know, it took 17 years, but, you know, more than a million children placed back into families, a whole generation of orphans that had been discarded back into family life. And I think that will change the nation of China.
I'm an adopted child myself, so I know from my own life the benefits that that brings. But you multiply that then by thousands and thousands, and you can see how a whole society, a whole generation, a whole nation can be changed by that.
In 20 years, fostering has gone from being an unknown concept to a national practice, and it all began in Shanghai.
What were some of your favorite success stories?
Well, you see them in the documentary. I mean, I think, you know, early days, that win, that football win was a great success because it was a cultural thing. It was, and you know, soccer breaks down wherever you are in the world, you can just break down all those mistrusts and those cultural things. I mean, traveling, some of the places I traveled to in China were absolutely incredible. And as I say, beautiful people in beautiful, you know, some of the provinces I look back at in Yunnan province, going up into, I took Francis Chan up into Luchan village, you know, where this very humble, quite poor community decided to take on all the children from the orphanage in the city and doing just incredible jobs with these children. Phenomenal stuff. I mean, some of the saddest things that, you know, I think I mentioned in the film, the earthquake in Chengdu, absolute travesty. And this year when, you know, it was China's year, they got the Olympics, and there was this huge, beyond any scale, earthquake that just devastated the whole province. The opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics, you know, absolutely incredible. I mean, it's just a privilege to have spent that time in history with, as China grew, you know, every time we went back to Shanghai, you just saw incredible growth. I think when we were there, they had a fifth of the world's cranes on the other side of the river. And you just saw like Manhattan come up overnight. Just phenomenal. But also, you know, in the book, As Many as the Stars, we talk about the young lad that my wife spent a lot of time, Elizabeth, with the poor and the street people. And we had a young lad live with us. And one of the amazing things was finding his mother and reuniting him with his mother, which was, you know, incredible. He lived with our family for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And to get him back home after he'd been just on the streets for, I think, several years was phenomenal.
Any stories that didn't make the film because of time constraints, or you just weren't able to get them filmed?
Yeah, I can't remember what's in them. I think I talk about the boy in the village, don't I? The bamboo stick boy. There was a little girl in Chengdu who had a hole in her heart. I don't know if that's in there.
No.
And, you know, we placed her into a family in Chengdu, and they didn't think she was going to live. She was tiny and she was very frail baby. And we placed her with his family. We went back actually with Jiang Ziyi. I don't know if you know Jiang Ziyi. Jiang Ziyi is the crouching tiger movie star. And she was in The Geisha Girl. She's, I think, the number one Chinese film star. Anyway, we took her back. And this little girl was absolutely, you know, blossoming. She got a little ballerina suit on and she was doing her moves, ballerina moves. And we were in the hospital because we were doing checks on her heart, but she looked very healthy. She went in with the consultant surgeon. They did tests on her heart, came out. And I never forget the guy lifted his glasses, wiped a tear from his eye. He said, "I don't understand, but there's nothing wrong with her heart." And it made national news in communist China. They called it the miracle baby healed by the love of a mother. It was, yeah, a very emotional time of a baby that probably, you know, most people hadn't only given her weeks or months to live. And here she was, sort of 3.5, 4 years, chubby cheeked and really cheeky little girl that the parents had done a marvelous job with her.
That's amazing. How did this film come about?
Well, I mean, that was all a bit potluck, because Matthew Gao, the producer, I met in Beijing when he was a young man. He got into TV business and he did a lot of the sitcom type of shows in China. And we talked about it for some time. And then he said, "Okay, I'll go back to Shanghai and see if we can do it." So he rang me actually from Shanghai and he said, "Look, this is impossible, Robert. To do a documentary, we need probably about 100 stories that we can, you know, film and then pick the best ones and make a movie." I said, "Well, what's the problem?" He said, "I can only find 5 in the whole of the city." So I said, "Well, you'll have to go with it." He said, "No, it will be a disaster." And I said, "No, just go with it." And we had this kind of little bit of a struggle over the phone. Anyway, he decided to go with it. And they are the 5 children. They're the 5 children. And so we always say, this is incredible, that those 5 transformational lives, miracles of lives, represent over 1 million children. And how many more stories are out there? You know, we just got to snip it, the ones we were allowed to get hold of. But yeah, one day we'll get to hear about all the others and all the families that were transformed as well.
Robert and Liz haven't seen Su Yiya since their charity arranged for him to leave the orphanage.
"We are so happy to get to know about you after 20 years.
Do you remember the earliest memory you had going to your family?"
"I was 9 years old, and they choose some boys and girls in a line. He asked one by one, 'Do you want a mother?' The one say no, the other one say no, but I say, 'Yes, I want.' So my mother choose me."
Tell us about some happy memories in the family, in your family.
So much. I was the first one go to university from our friend.
Quite remarkable, really. Suddenly out of this little boy comes this bright spark and you see fulfillment in his life where he's actually feeling, wow, I made it, I've done it.
Fostering orphans was a completely new concept in China and challenged 3 millennia of social convention.
Bear Grylls narrated this film.
That's right.
How did he get involved in this?
Well, Bear's been a friend for a while and he's done a few. You know, we traveled together. He traveled out to Hong Kong with me. He's been out to see the children. He's taken interest in it. He has a real love for what we do. And so when I asked him, and I don't ask him very often because, you know, if you ask him 10 times, he'll say no to 9. He said he'd do it. And wow, what an amazing job he did. I mean, the same with, you know, Francis Chan. You know, he's in there. He came to see the program himself. And I think he stands there and says, you know, I've been around the world and these are probably the most beautiful people I've met in my life. Every day we wake up and think about ourselves. They wake up and think about the children. And I think when you get to that level in life, when you see something that is that incredible about people, like these families, I think it really does, you know, hit home to you.
You're back in the UK. What are you doing now?
Well, we are still working in Thailand. We're working in Vietnam, and we're about to launch to Cambodia in January. So as we speak, I'm due to fly to Phnom Penh in January, sign an MOU with the government there. We've got our best person, who's our training officer, is going to go out, building a team, and we're looking to replicate what's happened in China, in Thailand, and in Vietnam, in Cambodia. So, and we've probably got about another 10 governments waiting, queuing up, saying, when can you come and help us?
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the next one is Indonesia. So while we're on the way to Phnom Penh, we'll stop off in Singapore and talk to people there because they're ready now in Jakarta for us to replicate there. So, there's a lot of work still to be done. While we've been in COVID, we produced the book, we produced a documentary. The message always has been children do better in families. You know, God made the family for children. So why would we put them in warehouses? Mm-hmm. We know, you know, mothers and fathers make a difference. And so the other bit that we've been doing is all our methodology, all our training, we're digitalizing. So what took 20 years to do one country, wouldn't it be wonderful through digitalization if we could switch that round and in 1 year reach 20 countries? So we're looking for people to get alongside us, support us, and help us digitalize all our materials so we can reach out further across the world.
Robert made an impression on the politicians because he's not a politician. Everyone could see that Robert was not in this for what he could get, but what the children would get.
If people are interested in helping, coming alongside, supporting, partnering, how do they get a hold of you in your organization? The organization is?
Care for Children. The website is www.careforchildren.com. You know, if you go to the website, you can get an email address there and just send an email. Yeah, we need help with that digitalization because we believe what we've done in China, we can bottle that. We can take it right. If it can be done in China, it can be done anywhere in the world.
Robert Glover, what do you want the biggest takeaway from this film to be?
I think the message to every child deserves a family. You know, some of these children start life in the most awful situation. They've been rejected, discarded. They end up, you know, in an institution, often very dark, damp places, without any nurture, stimulation, or love. And, you know, the message is that every child deserves the opportunity to live in a family. And I think when they do, you'll see from the documentary, Children of Shanghai, it transforms their lives.
Robert Glover, thanks for being on the Exploration Films podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Exploration Films podcast. To check out this film, you can go to our new streaming service, exploreflix.world. Exploration Films has been a pioneer and leader in the faith and family film space, and that's why we're so excited to tell you we finally have launched our own streaming service, exploreflix.world. If you or your family are looking for amazing films, compelling documentaries, unique stories, concerts, and Christian growth resources that all support your Christian worldview, then check out exploreflix.world and get 7 days free. All the films we talk about on this podcast and many, many more are available there. You can find a link at our website, explorationfilms.com, or you can go directly to exploreflix.world. For the entire Exploration Films team, I'm Steve Ryder. Thank you for investing your time with us.
That's a wrap.